The good, the bad, and the alternative. By Madame Melon Meow and Sarcastic Celery. Read by Sam Gabriel. Based on the works of Andrew Hussey. Chapter 20. Down Fell the Rain. Terezi.
May 7th, 7:15 a.m. CG.
Terezi, we've got her.
You.
Which her?
CG.
Both, thank the goats.
You.
Finally? Where were they? Is Kanaya in one piece?
CG.
At the present moment, yes.
You.
Will the witness elaborate for the court? What the hell does that mean? Do you need backup?
CG.
It means there's a metric fuckton to explain. Right now, it means you should clear out of the hunter's apartment before they decide to leave. And no, I don't need backup. Thanks, though.
You.
Are you stating for the record that you are not only with Kanaya and Vriska, but the hunter as well?
CG.
I'm in a pink electric bubble suffering attacks on all fronts about my potency as a leader. Just get out of there. Maybe move the stuff in the hallway back into the apartment if you can. The hunter's already going to throw a manic, paranoid hissy fit when he sees the state of the place. It would make him slightly less likely to start chasing me around with his bladeless handle if he didn't think the neighbors could have gone through his garbage, too.
You.
All right. No need to get your swim trunks in a twist. I'll scrape it back through the doorway. You owe me, though. I really don't like how some of these puppets smell.
CG.
Sure, whatever the fuck you want. A gleaming mountain of gold for your hoard.
You.
Hey, Pebblehead. Don't forget you're currently riding my hoard around like a cheap pony. It better be immaculate when I get back.
CG.
Yeah, I'll make sure all the roaches put their seatbelts on.
You.
I am shocked, Elder Karkles, at the flagrant disrespect for your constituent. Here I am, giving you my home and hoard to use in your time of need, and you call it dirty. I could have you court-martialed.
CG.
Jesus fucking Christ. I promise to return the hoard in one piece. But it might be a while. I have a lot of irons, as Vriska would say. I'll text you when I leave, okay?
You.
I will hold you to that. Smell you later.
May 7th, 8:30 a.m. CG.
Okay, everyone, let's make this short and sweet. First off, Kanaya and Vriska are both safe. Second off, I'm on elder duty until this shitstorm gets unfucked. Third off, there is no third off.
CT.
It would behoove you to share some actual information with us. Safe tells us nothing. What of the blood? What of the ritual?
CA.
Hey, what do you mean she's safe? I found a piece of her scalp, Car.
CG.
I promise that all parties responsible are being dealt with. And I promise to say more when Kanaya gives me the green light.
Everyone, guess who? ATW, Rose is totally the party responsible. Kanaya's not hurt anymore, but any of her spilled blood is Rose's fault.
TA.
No, VK, give the poor thucker his phone back before he blows the gasket. I can hear the steam from here. KK, let us know if you need something. Like a phone for VK so she doesn't steal yours?
CG.
Fucking hell. Thanks, man. Will do. Actually, can you and at CC do some sort of handoff? She's on her way here.
CC.
I can absolutely stop by Solex's place.
May 7th, 10:15 a.m. GA.
Hello, all. Thank you for your concerns. I've decided to share the broad strokes of what has occurred. As many of you know, Rose has been searching for a magical solution for her missing friend, Jade. This week she stumbled upon a ritual object that, upon Dave's translation, appeared to signal a way to converse with someone dear. In exchange for her promise that this would be the last, I agreed to assist her, Dave, and John with the ritual. The intent was to speak with Jade.
CC.
Instead, they summoned my mother, an emissary of chaos. The ritual object was my secret way to talk to her. Unfortunately, she doesn't listen to Reefson when she thinks I'm hurt.
GA.
I was attacked. Violently. For 12 hours, I was dead. Now I am something strange.
CG.
Vriska keeps trying to steal my phone to put forth her vampire theory. While it has little merit, it is an apt analogy. Kanaya rose from the dead with massive serrated fangs, an unbeating heart, bullshit strength, and a taste for blood.
CA.
Say it. Say it out loud.
CG.
Are you making a fucking Twilight reference right now?
CA.
Yeah. Duh. Sorry, Con, you're kind of giving a guy Twilight vibes.
GA.
Everton, it would be really funny if whoever did this decided to base me off the fucking Cullens. And I do say who, as it appears I have been cursed, but not by Feferi's mother.
AA.
Oh, no. I'm so sorry, Kanaya. I thought Dave was translating another dud. I didn't even check before giving him translation resources.
GA.
It is not your fault. I, too, believed it would be nothing.
CA.
Oh, shit, Con, I'm sorry for making light of it. Brissa, this is Rose's fault. Does that mean she cursed you?
CG.
We are not speaking about Rose and the origin of the curse yet. That is rampant speculation by a flighty broad. What matters is that Kanaya is okay now.
GA.
Yes, all my wounds have healed.
She's being modest. Our girl is a badass. She basically won the healing lottery. And I'm not a flighty broad. I'm just being real. Rose is the one who decided to do the bullshit ritual, so she's basically the one who cursed Kanaya.
TA.
VK, use your own phone. At GA, you need blood, you said.
GA.
I refuse to comment on Vriska's words. At TA, yes. Mr. Strada gave me some of his. I could use some more if I'm being honest.
CG.
Unfortunately, Mama's stock was used up when we were taking care of Vriska.
TA.
I'll make sure you get something nice to sip on. VK2.
GA.
I appreciate it, as does Vriska.
You.
I'm glad you're alive. I hope all parties responsible are being adequately punished.
CG.
No need for vigilante justice. I've got it covered.
May 7th, 11:50 a.m. AC.
Yep, I'm up to speed, and the party's still on, everyone.
Mm-hmm.
If the weather gets better, then it'll be a backyard bash for the ages. Pollux is supplying extra blood for Vriskers and Kanaya, who are exempted from bringing snacks. But I hope everyone else remembers what they promised.
Mm-hmm. See you all soon.
Terezi pulled the phone back from her ear, sighing in frustration as the screen reader played the last of today's message history back to her. She'd known the Carcat had yet to text her or to respond to the group chat again, but she'd still scrolled back up and re-listened to their previous conversation, just in case there was a message she'd missed. The windowsill made for an uncomfortable seat, but by dangling one leg inside the Hunter's trashed living room and the other outside the building, she could keep an ear on the street and the door both. Sure, Carcat had told her hours ago to leave, but that was a bullshit expectation. She wanted to be involved, to know what was going on. Just because the Hunter had given Kanaya a little sip, it didn't suddenly mean she'd trusted him. So after shoving everything from the hallway back into the apartment, she'd settled in to wait. Wait for what, she wasn't sure. Did she plan to jump the Hunter, to demand he enforce the rule of law? Was she hoping to spy on him, to eavesdrop for enough dirt to ensure he'd protect Vriska and Kanaya from other Hunters? The former had a body count, and the latter was a new type of monster entirely. She didn't think either of them were going to be safe if additional Hunters came to town. The sound of the elevator's ding broke her train of thought. Someone was home. Terezi took a deep breath, willing her mind to still. She had a few seconds before she was spotted, and she'd rather not be seen. Time slowed to a crawl. Her human form was an illusion. Sometimes she forgot that fact. It meant that she could change herself if she wanted to take on any visage she preferred. The one she'd been working on secret was an emulation of transparency. She felt her magic race over her skin in a wash of prideful, mint-scented turquoise. It bathed her in its glow, making the hazy outlines of the apartment dull in comparison. She imagined taking that light all around her and altering it. Instead of a glow, it silvered over, like the back of an antique mirror. Instead of radiating outward, she willed it to hover tight and close, just around her form. Footsteps echoed down the hallway. The glow was gone. The silver painted her. Now came the tricky part. Calling to the ambient magical energy around her, the distinctly sticky sweet chaos and the battered, broken glow of order, she asked it to come towards her, to carry the light in the room with it, and to bounce it all off her, to bend the light around her. She pulled her dangling leg up from inside the apartment, resting her foot on the windowsill instead. With the sky behind her, this trick had a chance of working. She felt the light glance off, saw the way she seemed to blend in with the drab, cloudy sky, just as the footsteps resolved themselves into a blurry figure standing in the doorway. She took a few sniffs of the arrival, teasing through the auras of Aleic chaos and shattered order. The figure's narrow form was shrouded in an eccentric combination of smell auras. One part was a sweet, fizzing cola, tickling her nose with its bubbly spritz. The other was muted, woody, bitter almonds. She recognized the combination as Kanaya's brother, not the hunter, but his younger ward. She knew him only vaguely, but he had a notorious habit of speaking his thoughts in a muttered, audible stream of poorly rhymed consciousness. Hopefully that would translate into something worth holding on to as potential evidence. Dave. Dave sat in the doorway to his apartment, cross-legged. His fingers steepled in front of his mouth. Everything but the walls had been torn apart. Even those were in great condition. The many deadbolts in the doorframe had been punched out, taking some drywall with them. It was like a bull had charged through the door and turned his place into a goddamn china shop. How it even smelled like a barn. Fuck, man, shit, where the fuck do I even start with this shit show? Dave stood up and went to kick a puppet across the room. Like God himself decided to reach down and flick Dave's balls. The puppet was one of the horseshoe ones. Dave cursed and seethed and grabbed his foot. It felt like he damn near broke a toe. That would be great. He could fit in with everyone else's bandages and get a cast or something. As he hobbled in a circle to walk off the pain, he heard the elevator chime. Shit, he thought. Gotta chill out, can't let that lab incident be the end of my reputation. He was surprised to see John's dad, Mr. Egbert, step out. Dave, how's it looking? He asked, clomping over and already wincing at the exterior of the apartment door. Straight up, not good. Less than not good, probably, Dave said. Mr. Egbert walked up beside him and looked on into the wasteland of the apartment. Right, he coughed. This is about how it was when I had to leave. I'd hoped those kids, the one that stuck around, at least put the furniture back. It looks like they didn't get around to it. Wait, what? Those kids you saw who did this? Dave asked. This was his Mojo Dojo, his Casa Su Casa, his Sanctum Sanctorum. He felt a sudden urge for vengeance swell up. Is my bro know who did this? Mr. Egbert nodded. He does, and if he hasn't shared it with you, then I won't be stepping on his choices as a guardian. Dave rolled his head back and groaned in disappointment. What I can do is help you out with cleaning up. Dave pulled his head back up. Nah. Mr. Egbert's paternal smile wavered. Dave, my boy, I would insist. Thank you, Mr. Egbert, but... Dave swallowed. My bro trusted me to take care of this. I'm not throwing myself on a cross or anything. It's just some cleaning, but it's our place. I gotta put it back together the way it's supposed to go. And if the guest we're expecting arrives, it wouldn't be a good look for you to be here. Mr. Egbert's hands were on his hips as he listened. He was giving a slow nod of acceptance, but then his eyebrows shot up. How about the roof? He asked. The roof? Dave said. Like the ritual circle and blood and shit? He thought about it. It was 100% the most pressing mess. If it was the only thing Mr. Egbert helped with, he'd be done and gone, hopefully long before the sheriff ever arrived, and he wouldn't be going through any of their actual things. That's exactly what I mean. It looked like a big job from what I saw. And you can keep my nose out of your things, Mr. Egbert said with good humor. All right, Dave said, quietly relieved. Cool. Dave knew, via the normal ways, such as bloody noses, cuts, and scrapes, that blood stained, but this was fucking awful. Mr. Egbert and him had been scrubbing hard for at least an hour, with bleach and water. The scorch marks had come off, but the concrete was still a nauseating rust color. Dave's knees were starting to hurt from scrabbling around on the wet roof. This might have worked if the blood was fresher, but I don't think we're going to get much further, Mr. Egbert said through the din of the waterfall. He pulled off the rubber dish gloves he was wearing. Would it be all right if I took a run for some supplies? Dave grunted as he pushed himself up from scrubbing. He took off his gloves as well, pulling on the insulating mask fitted over his nose and mouth. It had become soaked through with rain and sweat, and he could barely breathe through it. Sounds good to me, he said, pulling off his shades and wiping the droplets off before returning them to his face. He looked at Mr. Egbert through the fresh streaks across the glass. Mr. Egbert had grabbed the edge of his button-down and pulled it up to wipe off his face. Dave's vision had caught the edge of something dark on the older man's chest before Mr. Egbert dropped his hand from his face and stood up. Dave would shit himself if it was true, but it looked like the edge of some kind of tattoo. Don't worry, bud. I'll be back in a jiffy with just the right stuff to make this a cakewalk. He gave Dave an exaggerated wink before grabbing his bucket and scrub brush and heading down the stairs to the apartment. Oh, and don't stay up here. You'll catch a chill.
I catch nothing but chill, Big J. Chilling a damn yeti. You know I'm...
Dave let out a huge, gross sneeze that rocketed his sunglasses off.
Okay, fine. I'll get out of rain.
Mr. Egbert departed with a chuckle. Dave smeared the huge trails of snot off his face with a hand, flicking it off into the rain. He really probably should move before the rain turned from refreshing to freezing. He wiped his hands on his pants and stood up, grabbing his gloves, the bleach bottle, and the other brush. The apartment smelled a bit less like a barn now, though maybe that was the bleach frying his nostrils. Or maybe it was the open window, letting the cool breeze of the storm blow through the apartment. By some stroke of luck, the rain hadn't poured in too much. He'd still have to remember to close it at some point. He dropped the cleaning supplies in the bathroom and scanned the main room, or what was left of it. The sheer amount of shit to move was staggering. Various pieces of their furniture had been disassembled into their composite pieces. Cinder blocks were strewn about haphazardly. Bro's PC was on its side, the monitor disconnected and placed on the futon, which in turn was shoved at an angle that was driving one of the arms into the wall. All of the game consoles were disconnected in a similar manner, and it looked like every game case had been opened, then tossed aside into a pile. Bro's sweet turntable gear was all in the place it was supposed to be, but it must have been moved, then put back, based on how all the vinyls were half spilling from beneath the kit. The kitchenette was... Dave looked at all of the weapons scattered across the floor and spilling out of the cabinets. This probably was his first stop. Dave grabbed a gusarigama that was tangled with an inchaku. The sickle blade and wooden handles clacked together sadly. Dave sighed and dropped the mess into the sink. It made a gross squelch as it landed on the crimson-stained mop head from the first cleaning attempt. More than anything, he wanted to throw some fresh, unbloodied sheets on his bed and pass the fuck out, but he needed to clean this shit up. He couldn't not, it just wasn't a fucking option. If the other hunter got here and the apartment looked like a murder scene, all of the bullshit they went through would have been for nothing, not a zilch. Bro would be fucked over. Dave would be fucked over. Kanaya, John, Jade, Rose, fuck it, thinking wasn't helping anymore. Dave started taking deep breaths. There was one thing that might speed this up. He was only supposed to use this technique in extreme circumstances, or at least Bro said so, but fuck if this wasn't an extreme circumstance. Like water, Dave thought. Like rain. He felt his limbs sag and lighten at the same time, each breath almost lifting him off the ground. He bounced on the balls of his feet a few times, feeling his muscles contract and extend, first slowly, then faster and faster. For someone like Bro, with years of experience, his speed was instantaneous. But Dave needed a few moments to work himself up. He brought a few high knees up, the motion flashing his thighs up against his torso quicker than his eyes could follow them. He honed in on a target. The assorted kunai and shuriken feeling the speed bubbling up from his toes to his fingertips like a shaken soda. And then, snap. Dave was face down in the grimy carpet. Dave groaned, muffled. He kicked his leg and felt his jeans hooked under his heel, half pulling his pants off of himself. He felt like a dumbass. For a split second, he thought he heard snickering, but he looked up towards where it was coming from, and there was only the tapping of rain on the top pane of the window. Just the universe laughing at him then. Dave stood, pulled his pants up, and started hobbling over to his bedroom. It was graciously slightly less torn up, though his clothes had been thrown from his closet, and his mattress was half off the box spring. The pile of empty blood bags was still next to his bed, another cleanup task to add to the list. He rummaged through the mess of clothes on his floor until he found a pair of track pants, Adidas, obviously. He simply released his grip on his baggy jeans, and they fell to the floor in a wet heap. He kicked them the rest of the way off along with his shoes and pulled on the new pair. They were blissfully dry and, more importantly, tight around his ankles. All right, he said to himself. Take two. Terezi. Terezi clapped a hand over her mouth, desperately trying to recompose herself. She damn near guffawed when this dumbass ate shit because his baggy pants fell down. It was slightly concerning that he was suddenly able to move so fast it smelled like he was teleporting, but that was overwritten by the hilariously pathetic noise he made when his face hit the carpet. Now that Dave was in his bedroom, she took the chance to breathe deeply a few times, steadying her balance on the windowsill and trying to push the image of his nose smearing onto the floor from her mind. She'd managed to recover her composure by the time Dave came back in the living room. He was wearing new pants, and his movements seemed a bit more confident. Terezi settled to watch the circus, her nerves steeled for whatever hilarity was about to ensue. Tragically, he didn't spend the next 30 minutes falling on his face over and over again. After a few warm-up teleports where he stumbled but didn't fall, he started zipping around the room, cleaning the mess up with astonishing speed. Terezi started wondering if Karkat was right about not sticking around. She might have trouble if this guy thought she was some kind of intruder. Even his aura was disappearing and reappearing with only a lingering, fizzy bitterness. He was about halfway through the pile of game cases when Terezi heard the elevator ding. Dave must have been hyper-focused. His blurry form didn't seem to react. As Terezi took in the scents coming from the hallway, she didn't detect the calming, grassy rain of Mr. Egbert. Instead, she was hit with a pang of iron so strong it made her nose wrinkle. Appearing in the doorway was a figure stepping with a tipsy sway. Terezi could make out light-colored hair and skin, but it was the aura that made this figure stand out. Spells. Covering it from head to toe, perfuming it with a melange of lemony caution, wine-dark anger, a familiar minty pride. However, underlying them was a unifying note. Whoever this was had cast every spell themselves. That meant they were dangerous. Dave navigated the maze of sensory information until she found the root. Iron and sweetness, all overlaid with a potent saltiness. Terezi ran her tongue over her lips as though she could taste the salt in the air. It wasn't 3 cents, it was 2. Salted caramel and, well, the best way to describe salty iron, blood.
David, is that you? I didn't think I was so deep in my cups as to be seeing quintuples, the figure said with an affected northeastern accent.
Dave's speed abruptly stopped, and the game that was in his hand launched across the room at the figure. The unwieldy shape of the box prevented it from being thrown like a lethal weapon, and the figure tilted her head to the side just slightly enough that it sailed past her and into the hallway.
Jesus! Dave exclaimed. Don't sneak up on people like that, Doc Lalana was fondling my disc. Can't a guy fondle his disc in private?
You lost control of your disc and very nearly battered my face with it,
this Dr. Lalande said.
Well, shit, discs have a mind of their own sometimes. Just launch it up when you least expect it. Hunt for some drive to slide into. If a lady walks in, she better be expecting an eyeful. Mothers aren't ready for my modern technology, talking about my Nintendo 360. Got no idea the kind of hardware I'm slinging. This ain't my PSP I'm playing with under the cover, so don't come and ask why I'm not sleeping.
David...
Dr. Lalande interrupted, thankfully. Dave's hand stopped midair. Where he'd been gesticulating wildly as his ramble went off course, he shoved it in his pocket, and Terezi smelled the rotting pumpkin of embarrassment richly permeating his aura. Terezi's expression must have been somewhere halfway between disgust and awe. She'd been privy to a little bit of this guy's rambling when she'd shaken him down for quarters before, but nothing quite so Freudian. Dr. Huang from SVU would have a field day with him.
David, I'll do the favor of ignoring your tantrum, but really I'm just here to reinstate the wars in this building and sweep up the arcane remnants of your chaos ritual. Now, she unscrewed some sort of metal container that smelled like paint thinner. Take me to the scene of the crime, if you would.
Dave meekly began leading the woman up to the roof. Terezi's alarm bells went off. Arcane remnants and chaos ritual? Whatever this lady was doing was going to be far more interesting than watching Dave clean up his apartment. She'd never smelled human magic being performed before, either. Whatever this was, it was definitely going to be vital information. As Terezi started loosening her illusion so that she could fly her way to the roof in her true form, she was frozen by a sense of wrongness. The doctor's aura, it was pointed right at Terezi. As her body stood in the apartment door, Terezi felt the stare going through her. She stopped her transformation immediately, rubber banding back to the invisible humanoid form and holding her breath. Was this lady powerful enough to sense magic? That would explain why the hunter was trusting her for protection spells. After a moment of tension, Dave spoke up.
Hey, Doc, you coming?
Hmm? Yes, must be the lingering chaos.
The woman turned, letting the busted door slowly swing shut behind her. Terezi immediately scrambled as quietly as she could off the windowsill and over to the door, catching it before it clicked shut. If she couldn't fly up, for risk of her transformation alerting the woman, she'd need to follow them on foot. The carpet made it easier, but she still took each step with held breath. She heard their voices echoing down the stairwell, mostly Dave's. They were already halfway up. Terezi did her best to match her footfalls with the clack of Dr. Lalonde's heels, but every other step made a much too loud scuff as she hurried her way to catch up with them. Thankfully, Dave's inane mumbling provided some cover, and she was only a few feet behind the pair when they reached the door. "That'll do, Dave. Thank you very much." Dr. Lalonde waved the boy off with a disinterested gesture. "Cool, just don't track any blood down the stairs on your way out. Don't need another huge block of square footage to scrub like some fucking Cinderella." He started back down the stairs. Terezi pressed herself as flat as she could and held her breath as he walked, much too close for her comfort. She caught a few whispered murmurs. "Fairy godmother, not wizard godmother. Coming in smelling like pure ale, only wish she's granting his belts." His voice faded as he trudged the rest of the way down the stairs. She skittered up the stairs as soon as he passed, chasing the coattails of the doctor as they disappeared through the door. Terezi caught the door yet again, but allowed it to close with that metal lever door break thingy, allowing it to fall all the way to the thinnest crack, just enough for her to smell. Terezi heard the doctor make a noise of disgust, and knew why as soon as she stuck her nose in the door. A waft of bleach hit her sensitive nostrils, making her recoil. Carried with it was a torrent of other cleaning products and the ever-so-slight tang of old blood. "What a mess," the doctor said. Then Terezi heard cracking knuckles. "Let's start with the cleanup." She suddenly smelled a wave of burnt sugar passing over her, extending from the doctor. She pressed an eye to the crack to catch a flash of pink light, and heard indecipherable chanting. Human magic. Terezi opened the door a little wider to get a better sense of the rooftop happenings, assuming the doctor would be focused on whatever magic she was performing. A small breeze rushed through the additional room between the doctor and its frame. On it was the now familiar olfactory menagerie of the chaos magic and the buttery film of the protection magic the former had destroyed. Terezi waited, taking in all of it, as the burnt sugar smell intensified, reminding her of fresh cotton candy. The saccharin bloom spread out, growing in power as it grew in size like a roaring fire. Terezi couldn't help but take a step back, bringing the door closer to closed again for cover. The sugar. It was mixing with whatever Feferi's mom had left behind, stirring and penetrating the ochre ooze of emotions, turning it all into an eclectic experimental syrup flavor. In response, the oil-slick chaos started hissing. Not like an animal, but like water poured on a fire. As the sensation grew and grew, as did the doctor's volume, the chants sounded like some version of Latin now that Terezi could parse them. The burnt sugar was beginning to nauseate her, overwhelming her like she was caught in the suffocating smoke of a burning building. With a wince, she realized she had no other options. She slid back her aura sense. The absence of the additional perception felt like she'd lost a leg. But the mind-numbing power at work was no longer perceptible by her most sensitive organs. Squinting, she tried to determine what else she could from the blurry silhouette of the doctor. Another pinkish flash, this one sticking around just above the doctor's open hands like a flare caught in time. She spoke one final phrase and raised her hands above her head, carrying the light with it. "Chaos! Disperse!" A rush of wind blew outward from the doctor, slamming the door shut and sending Terezi skidding backwards with an oof. The wind was clear of any scent, sugary, chaotic, or otherwise. Terezi thought she had an idea of what the last phrase meant. There was no way the doctor didn't notice the door slamming shut, if not Terezi's undignified noise of pain. But she risked it anyway. She just wanted one more bit. Anything she could find out. She pressed her ear to the metal door and extended her aura sense once more, finding it, unsurprisingly, free and clear of any immediate sense. The doctor's saltiness once again tapped against Terezi's senses, and with it she heard her just a little clearer through the thick door. "Ah, poor chaos. If only you were as resistant to change as you were capable of enacting it. Maybe then I wouldn't have to deal with this bitch of a goddess, hallowed be her name. The latter half of the musing dripped. Sarcasm, a goddess, eh? Terezi had heard a thing or two about goddesses in her time. Maybe now was the time to bail. She didn't think her luck would hold out any longer.
David, was that you at the door?
The doctor called.
Shit,
yep. Terezi took the stairs down three at a time until she got to a landing with an unlocked window. She climbed out, shut the pane, and jumped.
Dave. Talking to Rose's mom like that, fucking stupid.
Dave muttered to himself while he pulled puppet after puppet from the scattered pile and placed them in various standard locations around the apartment, on the back of the couch, on Bro's reassembled desk atop the fridge. Bro seemed to move them every day, but Dave could at least estimate a configuration of the plushes based on the indecipherable, unspoken rules of puppet placement Bro followed. Purple ones were never in the kitchen, red ones stayed below eye level, one horseshoe puppet had to be hung from the hook above the doorway, and so on and so forth.
Might as well have asked you to bottle feed me, get your shit together, man.
Dave heard the clack of heels coming down the stairs and tensed as they approached the door. Some divine force, or maybe just reciprocal awkwardness, must have blessed him. As the footsteps of Dr. Lalonde went past the door and straight to the elevator without pause. The ding of its arrival was followed by muffled sounds of surprise and a conversation with the cadence of brief niceties. A moment later, Mr. Egbert opened the door to the apartment, a blush coloring his features and his hands full. One held a sealed bucket, some kind of chemical by the looks of it, and the other a jug of vinegar.
Yomistry,
Dave said, finishing up balancing a puppet carefully on the edge of the flat screen.
Dave, my goodness, you really got this place looking ship-shape,
Mr. Egbert said.
Dr. Lalonde passed me in the elevator, did she stop in?
Yeah, Dave said. She went and did magic on the roof, so it wouldn't like we got sloppy with Cthulhu up there. She also picked up the wards.
Well, she said so. I can't see that shit, so maybe she just lit some sage and left.
He shrugged.
Well, as long as she's done, we can finish up our end of the cleaning.
Mr. Egbert jostled the bucket, and Dave heard something powdery being shaken inside of it.
Sodium peroxide, he announced. If this doesn't get those stains out, nothing will.
Tight, Dave said. Let's get it. He walked over, but Mr. Egbert just handed him the jug of vinegar.
We can get it in a few minutes. This stuff is highly toxic while undiluted. I'll spread it around up there alone. Then we can both scrub once it's ready, he said,
and walked off to the stairs, not giving Dave time to argue. Dave thumped the jug of vinegar down on the kitchen counter. He looked around the room. It was looking pretty damn clean, given its prior state. Of course, he didn't want it looking too clean. That would be suspicious as fuck. Two brothers, bachelors each, living in any kind of cleanliness. Ridiculous.
Dave went to the fridge and retrieved a Sunny D, needing to push aside a rack of clear vials labeled Roman Orth, Holy, to grab it. He drained it and tossed the empty bottle in a tactfully messy spot.
Perfect.
That was his room done, the bathroom done, and the main room done. Dave's eyes drifted to the ceiling. Should he even check that room?
None of the sink knobs were twisted, and the mop having been intact indicated the garbage disposal hadn't been flipped.
Just a quick peek, Dave said to himself, make sure it wasn't compromised.
He walked over to the sink. He twisted on the hot water knob until it was at maximum, the steam fogging up his shades. He turned the cold knob next, hitting full power and then turning even more. It would seem to anyone else like the knob was loose or broken, but Dave twisted until he heard a metallic click. He flipped the garbage disposal on. The grinder gurgled as the water hit it. Finally, Dave turned the hot water and the disposal off simultaneously. The quietest thump sounded from above him. Dave turned around and looked up at the hatch that had been revealed in the ceiling. Any other time, it would be perfectly flush and seamless with the ceiling through some feat of magic engineering, but with the secret inputs, it opened like a hidden door in a fantasy game. From the slight crack that was revealed, a chain rolled out with a handle at the end. One brief tug later and the folding ladder came down, allowing Dave into the darkness above. The ladder jostled and creaked as Dave ascended it, but stayed sturdy. As his head poked into the yawning space, a good bit muggier than the apartment below, motion-detecting lights flickered on, casting the area in a bright white glow.
Racks and racks of weapons covered one half of the attic from wall to wall. The other half was shared by various bookshelves and containers filled with tools of the trade, a mini-fridge he knew to be full of liquids like the holy water downstairs, a chest of drawers Dave had seen Bro pulling what looked like old-school black powder bombs out of. Many of the weapons harbored a fine layer of dust, and Dave couldn't help a small sense of pride bloom in his chest for his Bro. The furthest wall was dominated by a bench covered in Christian paraphernalia, various crucifixes, a few brass censers and incense holders, some miniature portraits of Jeezy Boy, some votive candles, and a metronome. Bro had tried to teach Dave to meditate with the obnoxious clicking of this device, but he never got a handle on it. Regardless, as Dave did a precarious 360 on the ladder to scope everything out, he didn't see any signs of disturbance. His eyes caught on the colorful pile of puppets in the corner of the armory, sitting next to a folded camera stand, and he shuddered. These puppets had particularly plush features compared to the monster-deterrent ones strewn about the apartment. His Bro was an adult, whose tastes he had no business meddling in, but man, Dave was just glad he kept that shit separate from the rest of the apartment. Dave hopped back down off the ladder and heaved the bottom rung up. The whole apparatus shut with barely a clatter, the pole chain coiling itself back up along with it like some kind of tongue, and once again the ceiling looked perfectly featureless. Just in time, too, Mr. Egbert walked back through the door with an empty bucket. He set it down next to the trash can and pulled his cleaning mask off with a whew. "Now we just have to wait a few." He cracked his back. "If you don't mind me asking, how do you manage to get this place picked up so quick?" He glanced around the apartment, his eyes resting on the conspicuous Sunny D bottle for a moment. "Just moved fast, you know," Dave answered. He didn't know how to describe what a hunter technique was exactly, but going fast was pretty much all he did. Mr. Egbert pursed his lips in confusion, but just nodded. Dave leaned on the edge of the kitchen counter and crossed his arms, drumming his bicep. "You check on John and Vriska?"
"I did," Mr. Egbert said, all too happy to grab onto a blasé conversation topic. "Looked like they're gearing up to bake something. They seem to be getting along swimmingly."
Dave's heart thumped in his throat for a split second.
"Baking without your expertise and supervision? Sounds like a recipe for disaster," he said, trying not to imagine Vriska wiping flour off of John's cheek. "Well, John's practically a man now. I can hardly be hovering over his shoulder at every moment," Mr. Egbert said.
"Sure is," Dave rocked his head slightly.
"Not worried about Vriska, though? I mean, she's a vampire and a girl."
Mr. Egbert started.
I mean, alternatives are just people like you and me, Dave. We can't be prejudiced in times like these. As a matter of fact, I got to know a vampire quite well in Denver before we left."
Dave winced. Mr. Egbert clearly wasn't picking up on the picture he was painting.
"A very intelligent man. He taught me his family recipe for a mincemeat pie. Mr. Egbert, does Vriska seem like John's type? That's all I'm getting at."
Dave looked through the still-open window. Rain was starting to come through, so he walked over and shut it with a heavy thunk.
"Oh my, I see what you mean."
Mr. Egbert looked flustered, but was scratching his chin in thought.
"As a father, I find it hard to say. His closest friends have been you all over the internet, and, well, that Rose girl, you know, that's for the other team, as it were."
Dave coughed to hide a laugh.
"What about Jade?"
he asked. Apparently it was Mr. Egbert's turn to chuckle.
"To be frank, I think they look too much alike for John to think anything like that," he said.
Dave thought about that. They did share some similarities.
"As for Vriska, I don't know. John did seem enraptured for a while by that one vampire-looking gal from Scooby-Doo. She was in a band, I think."
"Hex Girls?" Dave asked, incredulous, turning around from the window.
"Yeah." Mr. Egbert snapped his fingers. "Had to pay a few late fees on that VHS rental, but aside from that, I can't say. He seems to be messaging you about 10 times more often than he talks about girls," he said, shaking his head but smiling.
Dave felt his cheeks warm, but tried to quash it.
"Why do you ask, my boy? Got your own eye on Vriska?"
Dave grimaced, though it was probably an exaggeration. Vriska wasn't repulsive, but he certainly hadn't seen her in any contexts where he could even conceive of her as attractive, first bedridden and practically in traction, then trying to kill Rose, and lastly, hovering over his sis like some underfed gargoyle.
"Now, I was trying to get blackmail dirt on your son," Dave said.
Mr. Egbert's eyes went wide.
"Well, hold on now," he began. "I won't be responsible for any coercive actions you mean to take towards John." Dave laughed, doing his best to let the tension out of the conversation.
Still, only joking, he said.
Gotta make sure no bloodsuckers are taking advantage of my homeboy. Mr. Egbert sighed in relief. That's a good friend. I'm glad John has you, Dave.
Dave swallowed. Sure.
That proc's out ready, you think? I hope so. Let's get it, Mr. Egbert said with a sly smile, grabbing his brush and reaffixing his mask. Dave grabbed his own equipment. This couldn't be over soon enough. Aradia had spent most of the day trying and failing to push down the lingering sense of guilt for her hand in the previous day's events. Unlike Vriska, she placed no blame at the feet of Rose or any of the other children. They did not know any better. How could they? They had not even reached their majority, and had only known the truth of the dangerous world for a mere 3 years. Aradia had centuries of experience under her belt. She had lived in the world of magic even in her first life. She was quickly becoming an esteemed archaeologist and expert in magical artifacts in this one. She knew better. She should have asked Dave more questions about the artifact, should have followed up with him regarding the translation results. The past, of course, could not be changed. No matter how hard she kicked herself, she couldn't undo her failure of due diligence. She'd cleaned the kitchens, walked the dogs, read every book in her library that even mentioned vampires, and now paced back and forth across the living room. She felt the urge to do something, but her energy was unfocused, chafing at her. Salix had left hours too early for the midnight market, wanting to get there when it opened, but that left her without someone to discuss the possible origins of Kanaya's curse. Maybe she should text Dave? Aradia glided to a halt, pulling out her phone. Once it was in her hands, a new thought burst to the forefront of her mind. She was given a task by her lord to help Jade. She'd given the girl a place to sleep. Salix had fed her and given her directions to the Lalande address, but that had been the extent of their interactions thus far. Perhaps she needed to change that.
May 7th, 4:05 p.m. You.
Hi, Jade. I just wanted to check in on you. I hope this is actually your number and you didn't ghost me.
Jade.
OMG, I would never. I just got really busy. I just found my teacher, though. But it turns out there was a lot of other stuff happening, so we didn't really get to talk. But don't worry, I'm safe. I'm learning a lot about myself.
You.
What about? I'm happy to lend an ear.
Jade.
Well, I guess since Beck is your friend, it turns out I might be part god?
Aradia set her phone down for a moment, contemplating the mechanics by which the Lord of Hounds could sire an outwardly human child.
You.
Well, that would certainly explain why Beck watches over you like a puppy.
Jade.
Maybe. Wait, no. Not part Beck, I'm part the other one.
You.
The other what?
Jade.
The other of the pair.
Aradia swallowed roughly, Jade's words hitting her in an overwhelming wave of dread. The God Eater. The girl was talking about being born from her. The very notion made her wish Jade had been referring to the Lord. That would be leaps and bounds less terrifying than this. As she struggled with a suitable response, she found herself recalling the memories the Lord had shared with her. Specifically the memory of Jade kneeling on a forest floor, decimating the foliage around her as she screamed. If she was the child of magic incarnate, well, that certainly explained a thing or two. Not that she could say that. Jade had been recalcitrant, to say the least, when Aradia asked if she could perform dog magic. She would have been covering up her actual ability and therefore her heritage.
You.
Oh, wow. That sounds like a big secret to keep from you. Did your teacher tell you that?
Jade.
Not exactly. She's been really busy. I haven't gotten a chance to see if she'd confirm the data. But the man who raised me left a journal behind. For when I was old enough, it's a bunch of letters, really. I haven't read much of it, but so far he's asserted that I'm the biological granddaughter of the capital G goddess.
You.
I did not know such a thing was possible. Not with that particular deity, at least. My people had stories of demigods, of course, as did many of the ancient cultures who still held personal relationships with their gods. But your grandmother's warriors and priests, hunters and wizards will tell you the rules are different for small gods and pre-secrecy civilizations. Be careful of who you share your heritage with. as they might call you a heretic for insinuating their grand mistress would mix with a mere mortal man.
Jade.
Oh, jeez. Grandpa always warned me about hunters thinking I was a witch or something. He wasn't my grandpa. He was my stupid father and just lied about it. Who does that?
Aradia paused, fingers hesitant on the keyboard. What could she say to that? It sounded as though Jade's father had hidden as much as possible. Finding out that her identity was irrevocably different from the way she'd been raised must have felt like the ground was ripped out from under her. Aradia knew that feeling, intimately. She'd done it twice now, but she had Salix by her side. Did Jade have someone she could rely on?
You.
I don't know. I'm sorry you had to find out through a letter left by the dead. I assume he was planning to tell you when you were older. Death has a way of ruining one's plans.
Jade.
Yeah. I keep getting really, really angry. He wrote that he was trying to protect me. Dr. Lalonde said that too. She knew I was online friends with her daughter and never told me. To protect my secret, she said. But there's more to it than being a quarter divine. There's so much that I don't understand about what they were up to, the research, the people who were supposed to be after me. It's overwhelming. And with everything that happened with my friends trying to find me, I feel bad. Giving them anything else to worry about. I don't know if they would understand anyway, growing up normal. And now I'm dumping this on you instead.
You.
No, it's okay. I did ask. I would not have done so if I was unprepared to listen. You and I have friends in common. I know what happened with Rose and the others. I'm sure once things settle, they'll be able to support you. But you are allowed to seek other sources of support. I've seen a lot over the centuries. I can provide a unique perspective. Beck seemed to think I could help you in some way.
Jade.
Thanks. Beck usually has good instincts. How is the whole dog priestess thing going anyway? Are there still a bunch of strays in your backyard?
She resumed her motion, planning to walk across the house to the back door. Instead, a bright green flash engulfed her, and she found herself standing outside in the center of the tent that had become her temple. She gasped, looking around at the fading glow of magic that clung to her. She had somehow teleported. An ability no ghost possessed, a power her lord demonstrated with the ease of breathing. As she checked her hands to make sure she wasn't fading, she saw she looked even more tangible than usual. She rubbed her fingertips together, feeling with uncanny sensitivity the ridges of her fingerprints and smooth sharpness of her nails. The sounds of barking nearby shook her from her reverie. She'd come out to check on the dogs, after all. The past few days had seen a steady stream of adoptions, to the point where she'd put up a sign for visitors to direct them. When she'd walked the dogs earlier today, there had been about a dozen left. Now only four remained, splashing happily in the mud. She recognized them as the same four that chased poor Tavros, the original quartet that had entered her home and brought her friends to her. Thankfully, the tent setup was keeping some space dry for them, but they were soaked to the bone. Maybe she should bring them inside to warm up? She watched a small, black-and-white terrier zoom past her across the yard, ears pricked and barking up a storm as he chased a clumsy tan mutt with a ball in his blocky maw. The two larger dogs were wrestling in a puddle. They looked happy. She could leave them to it. She adjusted her solidity to avoid the rain, then glided back across the yard and through the door. She headed to the living room, finding her phone abandoned on the floor where she'd been standing. Picking it up, she replied to Jade.
You.
I do not yet know the extent of my capabilities as Beck's High Priestess, aside from watching over the dogs. Many have found homes, but a few have stuck around. Four, to be exact. I think I might keep them.
Jade.
If you're going to keep them, you need to give them names.
Aradia chuckled at the notion, but then Jade started throwing an onslaught of suggestions at her. Her ideas for names seemed to primarily consist of the surnames of Nobel laureates in physics, whereas Aradia felt inclined to anchor a bit of her culture to the beasts. They landed on a few names. Zazzle, Fermi, Salixito, and Noir. Aradia wasn't certain how they came to choose the latter name, but it just felt right for the intense-looking, pitch-black Doberman mix. Aradia felt the knot of worry loosen as they conversed. She would worry about her spontaneous teleporting later. She'd check on Dave tomorrow, once the dust settled. For now, she would simply live in the moment. Karkat. Karkat rumbled up to the bridge in Teresi's van, killing the chug-chug-chug of its engine with a twist of the keys. He slid out of the driver's seat, making sure to dry the scratched leather off with a towel Teresi kept in the door for this very purpose. He'd been right about taking a dip in the harbor to find the troll kid that strange Fae had mentioned. Thankfully, they'd only been a short ways off from the dock. Upon interrogating them, he'd found out Eridan had apparently been shoved and strangled by a mob of insane humans, but the kid had also seemed a little too excited, recounting the events, and since Eridan had apparently been throwing Karkat's name around like some kind of patron, he'd been obligated to direct the kid to one of the available bridges in the city. As he swung the door shut to the van with a satisfying clunk, he craned his neck up and around the struts of his bridge for the teal lizard or the polychrome girl. "Teresi!" he shouted. The echo of his voice was muted by the rain. It was starting to lighten up, and Karkat could almost smell the fog that would surely blanket the city after the storm passed. He called again. Teresi ought to have been here by now. He'd texted her in the morning to leave the apartment. His mind started racing. Had she fallen in a hunter trap they missed while they were tearing the apartment to pieces? Did she fly into a perfectly clean glass window and break her neck on impact? Had Dave made it back before she left and mistook her as an intruder? "What kind of training does that guy even have?" Karkat started talking to himself as he paced around, looking for Teresi. "Could he be some kind of secret non-hunter hunter? Did he have any weapons on him? No, but those jeans were pretty baggy. Maybe strapped to his thigh?" Karkat abruptly pushed the image of Dave sliding up his pant leg out of his mind. He'd made it back under his bridge, back home, but he didn't feel relieved at all. He walked over to the edge of the water and sat. The cool current felt good. Odds were Teresi was just out doing other things. Dragon things, maybe. He checked his phone. Her most recent message was the same one as hours ago. He sighed and laid back onto the concrete. And there was so much bouncing around in his head. He wanted the river to wash it all away, pull the toxic waste downstream for some hapless fish to deal with. Unfortunately, the river was in no mood to sweep his troubles away with the current. Instead, he heard the roar of an engine, fast approaching. He stood, turning towards the sound. What the fuck? Who's stupid enough to drive in this? He squinted at the approaching craft, watching the familiar shape of Eridan's houseboat materialize. It was wavering erratically, bouncing wildly as it traveled upstream towards his bridge, 200 yards away and closing fast. Karkat glanced between the tall awning of the houseboat and the underside of the bridge, trying to account for how much higher the river had swelled with the fresh onslaught of rain. "They're going to crash." He rushed into the water, grasping and pulling the water in turn until it rushed into him, filling his muscles and packing him full of mass. He was going to need all the extra weight. Using the flow of the river to his advantage, he jetted through the water towards the boat. He could see Feferi now, alone at the helm. She was tugging on the throttle, trying to slow down, but momentum was against her. 100 yards. As Karkat closed in on the craft, he reached forward, massive hands ready to grasp the hull. He pulled more water in, felt his height triple. He was tall enough now to stand, head and shoulders both free of the water. He slammed to a halt, the motion catching Feferi's attention as the boat closed in. She shouted something, but the engine was louder. 50 yards. 20 yards. He braced. The bow of the boat slammed into his open palms with a cacophonous crash, a great shuddering blow that rattled him to the bones. A horrible screech followed as his hands slipped, sliding across the hull as the engine fought him, slid backwards through the muck as he grasped harder. His muscles screamed as he fought, knowing with every second of movement his bridge drew closer. From above him came a triumphant shout, followed by an absence. The motor had turned off, and with it, the vessel slowed, no longer packing enough punch to move him. He shoved, forcing it back, bleeding the last of its momentum. His hands ached with the force. When the damn thing finally halted, he gasped, glancing behind him. The bridge was a mere 20 yards away, the exact length of the boat. A few seconds more and the upper deck would have shredded against his bridge, launching Feferi like a rag doll. He shuddered at the thought.
He heard the heavy splash of an anchor hitting the water and turned back to the boat. Feferi was leaning over the railing, shouting at him,
"Carcrab, come up here! Some vassal fucked with the helm!"
She had a fistful of frayed wires in her right hand, and his heart sunk with dread. He thought she was just having trouble driving.
"Just a sec," he called up to her. "Give me a little room!"
She obligingly backed away from the railing, giving him the space to leap, launching himself up into the air and over the railing, landing on the deck of the boat with a thunderous crash.
"Whoops!"
Wincing apologetically, he turned back to the railing, spitting out a stream of water as he shrunk back down to a more polite size. His shorts, which had grown uncomfortably tight around the thigh, loosened considerably as he ejected liquid mass with force. Looking down at himself, he was relieved to find his clothes were miraculously still in one piece, though the masterfully embroidered hems were still a bit warm to the touch, sending a tiny puff of steam up as the grub's magical enchantments worked overtime to keep his modesty intact. Satisfied that he wasn't about to flash poor Feferi, he turned to face her. The rain had flattened her hair to her face, and dark streams of liquid stained the pale skin beneath her eyes. The inky liquid glimmered in the muted light, hidden depths of rainbow iridescence shimmering as she moved towards him.
"Tears?
Thank God you were here, Carcat. Look what I found!"
She presented those wires again, pointing out a series of nicks in the protective rubber coating and the blue-green stain of verdigris that smeared against her fingertips when she touched the exposed copper wires.
"Someone took a knife to the wires connecting the throttle to the engine, and when we sped away at high speed, these ones were so damaged by the blade and oxidation that they snapped. Who the shell would do such an awful thing?"
"Holy shit, I have no idea!" He reached forward, and she obligingly handed over the broken wires, allowing him to run his fingers over the cuts on the rubber. They were undeniably slash marks, sabotage indeed. Who would want to attack two teenagers running a soup kitchen?
"How did you stop the boat?"
he asked, looking at the wires in his hand. If pulling back on the throttle didn't work, what had?
"I had to go back and unplug the battery from the engine, actually."
Her voice took on an apologetic tone.
"I should have done it sooner, actually, but I'm not usually in charge of, well, all of this."
She gestured at the helm and around the boat in general.
"I'm just the first mate," she grumbled bitterly.
"Feferi," he began hesitantly, the conspicuous absence of Captain Eridan and the glittering presence of her tears forming an unsavory picture.
"I heard about the fight at the docks. The Hunter let me deal with it, thank the goats. A troll kid told me some crazy humans attacked Eridan. Have you guys been experiencing harassment from human supremacists?"
Feferi huffed in frustration at him before replying.
"Eridan was horrible to me. He said the old man called him a monster, but I'm not sure I believe him. He was really mean. But even if that guy was a bigot, this wasn't from today."
She held up her pale fingers, displaying the verdigris staining them.
"Oxidation doesn't happen overnight, right?"
"I guess not," he conceded. "Did this old man give you any trouble before?"
"No, he's just a homeless grandpa whose family died in a catastrophe. He was always really, really sweet to me. He said I was a polite young lady and he let me call him Pops."
She frowned, as though remembering something unpleasant.
"But Eridan did go on this whole tirade about how much I pass," she said disdainfully, "and seemed to think the old man was accusing him of eating me."
"That might explain why one of the witnesses claimed a gang of humans was trying to rip Eridan limb from limb." He grimaced, the sensation of the scorching desert returning to the forefront of his mind.
"You haven't heard of a fire elemental named Serenity, have you? She was the only person near the boat slip when I arrived. Put out a serious magical aura, drive me out like that."
He snapped his fingers once, sharply, for emphasis.
"Definitely not. I would have noticed something like that, I think."
Frowning, Feferi began walking under the awning, towards the cabin door.
"Let's go inside and sit down. I can make some tea if you want. Warm us up a bit."
She opened the door, gesturing to him. Carcat took a moment to subtly expel a bit more moisture to ensure he wasn't too tall for the houseboat's modest quarters.
"Sure, why not? I was hoping to chat with Terezi, but I'm sure she'll notice the 60 feet of fucking houseboat parked in the middle of the river and swoop her scaly ass down here."
She smiled at him widely, and he obligingly joined her inside. The houseboat was very economical in its layout. He knew from past sleepovers that the sofa folded out into a bed, and between that, the L-shaped bench next to the dining table and several chairs, plus the high chairs facing one of the kitchen counters, they could accommodate plenty of guests for group hangouts.
Feferi bustled through the kitchen, hastily passing by the two bedrooms to enter the second bathroom, the one with the shower. Karkat took a moment to carefully place the broken wires on the dining table where they'd be safe. He'd need them for evidence later. She emerged from the bathroom with two fluffy towels in hand, wrapping one around herself and passing him the other. Thanks. He made short work of drying himself, absorbing what moisture he could to remove the water from his clothes at the expense of bulking up slightly. The towel mostly served as a blanket, as well as a barrier to keep him from staining the sofa as he sat.
Tea. Peter gave me a box of fancy blends last solstice. There's some earthy ones. I know you don't like floral flavors.
She unlatched one of the kitchen cabinets, pulling out a wooden box with a catfish painted on it in lifelike detail.
Dealer's choice. I think I'll hang out for a while, if that's okay.
He was pretty sure she could use a friend, with Aridin being horrible and the sabotage scare.
For sure. I don't have any plans for a while, since we had to cut and run.
She busied herself with a pot of water on the stove for a moment.
I hope nobody went hungry because of us. You really didn't see any of our regulars? Just the troll kid and that Serenity person?
She began measuring spoonfuls of tea from a little baggie, the box open on the counter next to the stove.
Everyone else cleared out pretty fast. The troll kid said you scared them something awful. My guess is everyone ran for the shelters or one of the other kitchens in the city. Don't worry.
He attempted to project a confident tone, hoping it would reassure her. He honestly hadn't found where many had run to, but she didn't need to hear that right now.
I guess I did let a bit of chthonic slip into my voice when I was trying to get rid of the crowd. But you should have seen it. Everyone was raring for a fight.
She was looking for clean mugs now, shoving aside a few gaudy ones that clearly belonged to Aridin in favor of two chipped mugs sporting a stylized capital A, with a capital L inside the upper portion and an F inside the lower. She gave them a melancholy look as she poured their tea into it, then made her way to the couch to join them.
Karkat.
She looked at him nervously as she sat, handing him his mug so she could clutch hers with both hands. The tea smelled nutty, with small brown bits floating among the leaves.
Aridin left me. Like, really, really left me. Said I could keep the boat, acted like he was tired of trying to please me. As if I'd asked for some great sacrifice, and wasn't a good enough friend to deserve him putting in that sort of effort.
She scrunched up her shoulders defensively, misery clear in the tremble of her mouth and the oily sheen in her eyes.
He was acting like I'd drawn some line in the sand. And by being angry at him for punching a weak old man, I was choosing humans over him.
Her voice wavered and she took a sip of her tea to cover. While he tried to gather his thoughts, he did the same. It was a bit bitter, and had a toasted flavor to it. It was no coffee, but she'd chosen well. It was pretty tasty.
That fucker! I don't know what's wrong with him lately. The guy can't make up his mind. I thought his crush on Dave was going to signal a turn for the better, not set him back 3 years in his attitudes.
He looked at his friend, trying to catch her eye. She was staring down into her tea, not meeting his gaze.
He had no right to say those things to you. I know you both lost everything in the catastrophe, and it couldn't have been easy trying to build a new life away from your family. I hope the soup kitchen would help Aridin soften up a little, see all humans as people, not just Kanaya.
He paused, blanching. Kanaya wasn't human anymore. He'd need to speak to some of Mimi's turn to find out what sort of hurdles a trans-species individual would have to face. But that was a worry for later. Right now, Feferi needed his attention. Kanaya had her mom. Feferi didn't.
It's worse than that. He's been going to the Midnight Market, and it sounds like some creepy extremist has been filling his head with the worst kind of rhetoric. He called the humans an awful slur. Anything I said, he turns it against me. He sounded like he was glad he got us sheltered. That it proved his bad attitude right about humans. I'm pretty sure he started the fight. Anyway.
I don't like the thought of Aridin mixing with the sort of people who hang out there. I guess it would be too much to ask him to not shop there at all, right?
Feferi nodded in confirmation. None of them were totally sure how critical human meat was to a siren's diet, but Aridin had acted as though there was something important about the practice. Even if he'd been a pretty poor hunter before the catastrophe, it made Karkat uncomfortable if he thought about it for too long. But then again, some bridge trolls were sapient eaters as well, not to mention the hags like Morgan.
He did say he buys from someone who receives ethical donations, and that Sholux had vetted this Holga for him.
She volunteered the information, shifting uncomfortably as she said it.
Still, I wish he could buy from a place that had to verify their sources like a regular butcher does, not a skeevy secret dive that peddles blood slaves in the next booth over. Solix usually has good judgment, but if Eridan's chatting up extremists while grocery shopping, I might have to talk to him if he fucked up somewhere along the way. They both took a moment of silence to sip their tea, Karkat mulling over what to do about his wayward friend. If Eridan had really left Feferi, with all the finality that entailed, where would he go?
Do you think he'll come back?
She asked him softly. She looked so pitiable as she said it, that the response slipped free before he had the chance to think. Do you want him to come back?
Well,
I mean, you said he was a dick to you, insulted you, and acted like you were a traitor to all of alternative kind. It's okay if you don't actually want to see him for a bit.
He tried to be reassuring, but wasn't sure if it worked.
I don't want him to run off and join a gang or something. But I don't think him coming back and seeing the mess someone made of our boat would do him any good. Might rile him up further, actually.
Uh-huh. He raised his brow at her. You're allowed to say he hurt your feelings if you need space from the guy. The two of you have been jammed in close quarters like...
He paused, hunting for a metaphor that would cheer her up.
Like sardines in a can?
He finally offered, and was rewarded with the hint of a smile.
Let me worry about him turning an argument with you in a fight with an old man into a federal fucking issue. You don't need to stress about his bullshit when he's the one who upset you.
She sighed, then looked up at him, rolling her eyes.
Yeah, you're right. I'm overestimating him, and his dramatics get to me. He's probably going to go beg Sholix for a deal. Not go looking for more trouble. You'd probably find him using borrowed magic to shoot holes in trees all dressed like his claws and armor, Commandant.
What the fuck does that mean?
Karkat was bewildered. He knew Eridan had an expansive list of games he played, but that one didn't sound familiar. It's his and Vriska's homebrew game, where they pretend alternatives were involved in human wars. A no-secrecy historical reimagining, he called it. He plays with various French forces, but they can blast spells like cannon fire. It's silly. He begs magic off Sholix all the time when he's moping. That's why he helps do the gardening over there.
Oh, well, there you go. He can blow off steam at their house. I can ask Aradia if she has room to spare, and I'll bring over a bag for him so you guys don't end up fighting again.
I think that's for the best. I don't want to see him unless he decides to apologize anyway.
He managed not to blurt out how slim a chance there was of that happening anytime soon, given how arrogant the siren could be.
Right.
He desperately searched for a change in topic, anything better than Eridan's fuck-up. His eyes came to rest on the bag on the counter, the one Feferi had shoved her heirloom into.
Have you gotten in touch with your mom yet?
Her gaze followed his to the heirloom, and she stood up, crossing the room in moments to retrieve the bag. Leaving her mug in its place, she returned to the couch, reverently sliding the intricate carved whalebone free. There was a frankly uncomfortable amount of blood staining it, but she didn't seem bothered as she delicately traced the marks.
No, not yet. It can only be used at the sunrise before a full moon, unfortunately. I have to wait a whole month to talk to her. I just hope she doesn't do anything rash in the meantime. I have no way to tell her that I'm all right. But I doubt she thinks I gave up my only way to talk to her willingly.
Karka had the feeling he could add gigantic fucking tentacle monsters to his list of issues to bring up with the Elders' Council.
Well, when you are able to do the ritual, let me know. I'll give you a ride in Terezi's van since Strider doesn't want you summoning her in city limits.
He gently reminded her of the Hunter's warning, sure that she'd forgotten it in all the chaos.
Oh, thanks a bunch, Karkrab.
She beamed at him, the moment making the tear stains on her face gleam with the light of the cabin.
I can't wait to see her. I missed her so much. Do you think she'll be able to fix my skin?
I don't know what your mom is capable of, but she's basically a god, right?
She nodded.
In that case, I bet you can do some spooky chaos stuff and melt the fabric of the universe together until your skin is good as new or something.
He was entirely out of his depth, but it sounded good, and she certainly seemed to agree.
I'll make sure to ask her about Kanaya, too. I know she didn't do it, but maybe she's heard of such a thing? She's been around a long time, after all.
That's a good idea. The more help we can give Kanaya, the better.
Karkat sipped his tea and looked out the rain-spattered glass door. It was starting to feel like the closer everyone was coming together, the further they were being driven apart. He hoped Terezi would be home soon.
Terezi. Terezi soared through the sky, feeling the light rain along her spine as she flew towards her bridge. The weather dampened the smells and sounds of the city below, but the wafting flow of auras was not subject to such physical concerns. Her wings hummed with power. She was used to the sky being all hers, with how high she flew and how volatile the weather had become since the catastrophe. Not many of the airborne denizens of Houston had been prepared for the changes in pressure caused by their new coastal existence. Thus, when the smell of salt and ozone came bearing down upon her, she thought of a strangely dull lightning strike, hidden by clouds and her own blurred sight, not the feathered visage of her friend. It was only when the violent combination of bitter grape and sour lemon invaded her nostrils that she realized her error and jerked upwards, dodging the desperate fury that fueled Eridan's reckless flight through the storm. What the hell was he doing? She was reminded of a particularly volatile guy from the foster home, one who tried to kill himself by running straight at a cop wielding a toy sword. He had smelled the same, desperation and fury making a noxious cloud around him. With dread sinking in, she combined the emotional evidence with his trajectory. There wasn't a police station where he was headed. He was following her own flight path in reverse, flying straight for the hunter's lair. With the flap of her wings, she sped towards him, the darkness of his wings now obvious against the mottled gray of the clouds. Flapping in the wind between his wings, something colorful streamed from his neck. His shock was the sour scent of crabapple, and she quickly released him, dragging her claws free of the fabric. He was slowing, turning, that bitter tenon fury renewing in strength as he sought out his attacker.
"Rezzy, what the Hades is wrong with you?"
he snarled, aggression evident in his beat of his wings as he kept himself in place with more force than necessary. She had no human voice with which to respond, so she darted down, pointing with a forepaw towards the ground, then zipped back up to his eye level. Somehow the grape scent intensified.
"Get the fuck out of my way! I don't have time for whatever bullshit games you're playing!"
The sourness of his desperation crept up as well, subsuming the initial shock from her appearance. He shifted in the air, as though looking for an opportunity to dart past her. She needed to take drastic measures. Before his erratic behavior worsened, frustrated by her inability to explain, she snarled, shaking her head. Whatever he thought he was up to, she had no intention of letting him go through with it.
"I'm warning you, I'm in no mood for this. Get out of my way before I make you move."
His hands moved, and she guessed they were balled into fists. All right, two can play that game. Letting out a spark of flame to show she meant business, she charged directly at his face, flaring her wings to wallop him in the head. Before he could recover, she clung to his chest, then shoved her magic hard, forcing herself to shift human in a flash of bright light that stunned him. Now equipped with hands, she wrapped them around his torso, clutching him for dear life as he shuddered with the new weight, dropping through the clouds while he fought to get his bearings. With a grunt of exertion, Eridan stopped their fall. She felt his chest heaving and hastily spoke before he could begin another tirade.
"Take us to the ground, right now. Whatever the hell has you so worked up, I can't let you fly into the hunter's airspace like a madman. It's been freshly warded, you idiot. If you keep oozing this much ill will, it'll fry you before you get close."
The air was much colder, the rain much less comfortable. Now that she'd given up her true form and the fire nestled within, she shivered, trying not to think about the drop far below. His own arms had wrapped around her as though on instinct, but his fury still shimmered all around them.
"Something is seriously wrong with you. I have half a mind to drop you."
He ground out the words through gritted teeth. A small hint of lavender wafted up, and she hoped the frustration was a sign that the fury wasn't truly aimed at her.
"Ha! As if!"
She grinned widely, as if completely unfazed by the thought of falling.
"You're too chicken to kill a friend just for pissing you off,"
he sputtered, the rusty tang of his offense wafting up.
"You're clinging to me like your life depends on it, and you call me a coward?"
"I'm grabbing you so I can talk to your dumbass, since you refuse to land so I can do so safely," she shouted. "Now drop, before I grab your wings and powerbomb us both into the pavement."
Eridan made a sound of disgust, but he slowed his wing beats, letting the both of them slowly descend through the air until they touched down on the roof of one of the shorter apartment complexes in the area. The building had a small entertainment patio on its roof, consisting of a pavilion, a few deck chairs, a fire pit, and a grill. Understandably, none of the tenants were up here.
Once they were both under the shelter from the rain, Teresi crossed her arms at Eridan expectantly.
"What's your problem?"
Eridan yelled.
"What's your problem? You're about to plow into freshly made hunter wards while dripping murderous intent. You would have been zapped like a bug."
Teresi threw her hands out.
"Well, you pinpoints my fucking problem then. The hunter and all the shit he stands for."
Eridan kicked at a deck chair, his talons raking deep gouges in the wood.
"What are you even talking about?"
Teresi asked. Eridan was clearly torn up about something. This wasn't his run-of-the-mill anti-human shit.
"I got jumped."
He slapped his hand to his chest. It made a wet noise against the rain-soaked fabric.
"At the fucking soup kitchen! I'll just ladle the monkeys some slop and you'll learn to love them!"
Eridan went off in a vaguely accented falsetto. Was that supposed to be for fairy?
"Fucking centaur shit! They see the first sign of alt solidarity and they all turn on you like an animal!"
Teresi's eye twitched. Putting together a clear picture from his ranting was straining even her detective capabilities.
"What, did you fight with Feferi?"
she asked. Eridan was pacing back and forth, talons flexed and scraping against the bricks.
"No, no, no, no," he wagged a finger aggressively. "Feth picked a fight with me. I defend myself. Some true alts come to help me, and she runs in and saves the humans worth his hides, drags me off on the fucking boat, and goes off me like I'm some kind of psycho. After all I've done for her, you know how much I've done? Everyone does, only she doesn't want to think about it. She hates living like a human, but can't live without them. It doesn't make any fucking sense, Rezzy."
Teresi blinked.
"You're telling me a bunch of humans tried to kill you, you fought them off, and when pedestrian alts came to help you, Feferi arrived too and protected the humans?"
"Pretty much!"
Eridan gestured angrily in every direction.
"I guess if she can talk to her mum again, she doesn't need me anymore. Might as well be a damned harpy with all the fucking garbage I've eaten for her benefit!"
He laughed, but it didn't have any humor in it.
"Could you imagine that? Tell all the humans you meet for years you're some stinking spirit of spoilage, just so they aren't scared you'll eat them!"
He looked over at Teresi's perfect human disguise.
"How am I even talking to you? You fit in just as damn fine as her! I need to talk to Eck."
"Fit in?"
Teresi barked a laugh.
"I don't have to imagine not being able to be myself for years. Or do you not remember that?"
Eridan's aura leaked a crisp, watermelony confusion and a hint of pine needles regret.
"I mean, we've never talked much, have we?"
"Yeah, we haven't. Frankly, I stopped you on the principle that I wouldn't let anyone walk straight into a lethal voltage electric fence, and Vriska still hasn't gotten her game out of you,"
Teresi said. Eridan deflated a bit.
"Thanks, I guess. Sorry for strangling you, I guess,"
Teresi intoned.
"So what, your issue is that humans don't like you and Feferi likes humans?"
"That's more complicated than that."
"That sounds like a yes to me,"
Teresi interrupted.
"Here's my advice, not as legal counsel, mind you. Stop giving a fuck about how everyone looks at you."
"Easy for you to say,"
Eridan murmured crossly.
"Wow, because I'm blind? That's low even for you."
Teresi sighed and shook her head.
"What fucking... No, it's not even close to all."
"Lucky for you, I have thick skin, in large part because I don't give a fuck about how people look at me. I spent my whole childhood without even knowing I had a body that belonged to me, that made me feel like who I really was inside. You're telling me you knew who and what you were all along and you're going to let people's judgment take that joy away from you?"
Teresi prodded him in the peck.
"You're going to give a fuck about clothes and hair dye while cursing humans in the same breath? You're wearing a scarf while flying in a thunderstorm. You know how easy it would be to get that snagged on something and go rot you midair?"
Eridan's aura intensified, the smell of lightning coming through more strongly. It had the double effect of making it smell like his brain was frying as she grew him new synapses with her straight talk.
"Get all your troops in line, General. Then you'll be able to make some progress. Got it?"
Eridan slowly nodded. "I think I'll get it."
"Good,"
Teresi said.
"Once you've gotten over all this, you can go talk to Feferi and—"
"I need to be who I am inside,"
Eridan declared.
"And what I am is a predator. I'm above humans. They should be bowing and scraping to us. Enough of this fucking charity. We deserve to rule the world."
Teresi smelled a triumphant blast of minty pride off Eridan.
"Huh?"
Teresi asked.
"No, that's not
you, Teresi."
He leaned over and hugged her much too intimately. She cringed and pushed him off, but he didn't look deterred.
"I know what I have to do. I'll see you at the party, yeah?"
Before she could answer, or clarify that he'd taken the entirely wrong message, he ran to the edge of the building and took off, letting his scarf flutter down to the roof behind him. Teresi was sure this wouldn't have any long-term consequences. Aradia.
Solix slammed the door open with a flicker of his magic, catching Aradia by surprise. He had the cooler in hand, a sour expression on his face. He kicked off his shoes with force, seemingly unaware that she was gliding over to meet him. With a wave of her hand, she stopped the rain-soaked shoes before they could go flying, sending them to gently rest on the floor instead. He looked up at the movement, meeting her eyes, and there were dark shadows beneath his mismatched eyes.
She didn't see you there.
He put down the cooler, shut the door with a twitch of sparking fingers, and closed the space between them, pulling her close in an embrace. He was damp from the rain, but the smells of the market clung to his skin, a cloying combination of heavy spices, sulfur, and blood. For a moment he simply held her, his face buried in her hair. He soon pulled back enough to find her lips with his own, but the kiss was brief, distracted, and over far too quickly for her liking.
"Are you all right?"
She searched his expression for answers, prickling with concern. He pulled away entirely, retrieving the cooler with a scowl.
"Let me get this in the fridge. Don't want to lose an ounce with how much it costs."
He headed for the kitchen, Aradia following after. The bitterness in his words was palpable.
"How much was it?"
She caught up with him as he placed the cooler next to the fridge, opening both. She leaned down, grabbing a few bags to pass to him so he could stack them in the fridge.
"Over 3K for 2 measly gallons. Holger told me there was a demand problem."
He paused, hand mid-reach for the bag she offered, looking at it with a furrowed brow.
"A mind vamp offered to spot me, then stumbled into my mental ward with his clumsy fondling. Idiot got a bloody nose for his trouble, and he still tried to serve a shitty pamphlet at me on his way out."
He took the proffered bag, placing it in the empty veggie drawer they'd cleared earlier in the day to host the blood.
"A pamphlet?"
Alarm bells were ringing at the mention of a nosy desert dweller buying up the blood supply.
"He wasn't a missing poster for Vriska, was it?"
"No, this was some sort of activist thing. Human isn't default, pun intended."
He snorted in derision. She continued passing bags of blood to him while she considered the statement. Her knee-jerk reaction had been to assume Salix had met a follower of Sirket. Nevada was a blackout zone, but she'd heard from Equius that the cult had sent soldiers in the aftermath of the collapse to search the Pharaoh's borders for the errant heir.
"Are there other cults of the desert variety, other than Sirket's?" she mused aloud, only half expecting an answer.
"In the U.S.? There's no reason I would know that. It's not like I was tracking the mind vamp population or something."
Salix was lying to her face, and he knew it. Before she could call him on the deception, he spoke again.
"If the alternate was back, I could write an algorithm to figure it out, or troll the board for rumors. But without it, who knows how the landscapes of power have shifted in the meantime. For all we know, Vriska isn't the only defector. Maybe the blackout was to prevent information escaping while Pharaoh Sirket licked her wounds."
She could sense his uncertainty as he spoke, like he was grasping at straws, trying to find a rational answer.
"So they decided to come to Houston and become activists, why here?"
"That's if there is a they. Maybe that Ramos guy is by himself and he's aimed at artificial scarcity in the blood market."
"Activists would want the blood to be more accessible, not less. Are you suggesting a desperate act of capitalism instead?"
"Maybe."
He spoke darkly, movements stiff as he loaded the final bags in the fridge.
"Or maybe he's just trying to put Holger out of business. She's about the only ethical dealer for a 50-mile radius. He looked like a heartthrob right out of a magazine. He could be a dealer of his own."
The unspoken implications laid heavy in the air between them as Salix shut the fridge and stalked to the coffee pot. A mind vamp dealing blood wouldn't be stopped by legal trivialities like informed consent. If he wanted to offer it fresh, it would be easy. He could whisper his way inside a mind and march the victim into the fangs of the buyer, jugular happily exposed. A common vamp with no exposure to their more talented cousins would assume the donor was willing. They'd love the intimacy of a fresh bite, far more than Holger's carefully packaged pints.
"You're reaching, my love. Maybe there's an uptick in demand because of the election."
She offered the possibility hesitantly. She wasn't much for the radio, honestly, and had not been following the campaign coverage. But Karkat had mentioned something, she was pretty sure.
"Is it one of the candidates supposed to be visiting Houston this month?
Meeting the Elders Council, holding a rally at City Hall?"
"The old guy who was running as an independent? Waylon Vargas?
I think so, but he's not a vamp, is he?" Solix was fidgeting with his cup, a crackle of nervous energy making the spoon in his hand spark as he mixed heaping spoonfuls of burning sugar into the dark brew. The demonic taste for the extreme manifested in strange ways. Worry furrowed his brow. Maybe her counter-theory wasn't fleshed out enough to lead him away from that dark train of thought. She tried again,
Ephraimos is part of an activist group for alt-rights. The candidate wouldn't have to be that for the group to want to see him. Any alt is better than an all-human ticket, right? She opened the fridge, looking for the chocolate syrup. She was getting a craving for something sweet, too, but a mocha sounded nicer than the gritty concoction her partner was so fond of. His giant, bee-themed mug was close to overflowing, and yet he continued in his quest to demolish their sugar supply.
That's stupid and reductive, like internet feminists cheering for Margaret Thatcher. But the idiot did try to give me his literature after I bitch-slapped him in the psychics. Maybe he doesn't give a fuck about the candidate's actual politics. He pulled down a mug for her from the cabinet above the coffee pot. An ironic gift from Dave featuring Casper, of all things. Or maybe the blood uptick is the result of a bunch of fresh turns in the city to artificially increase the alt vote, he continued. Maybe Vargas is a mind vamp, and these are his cult, he to enforce his will. She glided forward to meet him, syrup in hand, and proceeded to mix her own drink while she responded.
Are you actually that worried about the motivations of a stranger, or are you just angling for ways to focus on doom and gloom? She spoke softly, glancing in his direction from under lowered lashes, trying to subtly watch his reaction. I know the midnight market brings to mind dark memories. Are you seeking out a conspiracy to rationalize the emotional response simply stepping inside Awakens? Salak stiffened, hastily bringing his mug to his lips, the thick brew spilling past his lips and trickling down his chin. As he drank deeply, his other hand, limp at his side, was shaking. Within moments, the cup was empty, though she doubted more than a third had actually made it down his throat. His gaze was blank as he set the cup down, and the wet stain on his shirt dripped, unacknowledged, hitting the kitchen floor in dark, sticky droplets. The smell was sickeningly sweet, acrid where the singed sugar clung in charring lumps. The stench of the market was stronger, despite the mess. Some of my clients were alts, you know. His voice was distant. He did not look at her. Mind vamps from the Tabernath Desert, seeking cheap thrills from a more durable plaything. They made deals with higher-ups in the collective, and I was the one bound to the terms. No mental wards allowed back then. Her stomach turned at his words, the way they echoed in her mind. She wasn't meant to hold centuries worth of memories. Was this something he told her before? That she'd lost. Uncertain she whispered his name, he continued speaking, as though she was silent. There's something I never told you about the alternate. You asked if there could be mind vamps from a lineage other than Sirket's. I was tracking them, using curse code to find out if the Spaniards from that time was still around, if any of them were here. His words confirmed what she'd already guessed from his earlier lie. His hands reached for his hair, pulling at it in frustration. It was supposed to be a fail-safe. Give me forewarning, just in case. But it only worked if the alternate worked. Without it, I can't be sure. Vargas Ramos. I don't recognize the names, but a modern politician wouldn't advertise his affiliation with a historic conquistador. And Ramos might be a bastardization of Ramos. That would mean they both have Spanish names. The word conquistador stirred something deep within her. Memories from the beginning of their time together, they were vague, blurry. The memories of a fading ghost from before he dug up her ancient bones and made her soul eternal. Unbidden, words sprang to her lips, an echo from the past. She felt ancient parchment heavy in her hands.
I, the spectre known as Aradia Megiddo, do claim custody of the services contract of the demon known as Salak's captor, as successor and assign of Francisco Hernandez de Cordoba. The blood of the assigner here marks this assessment as true.
Salak stared at her, shock widening his eyes. His pupils were dilated, engulfing his irises, dark pits that seemed to swallow her whole. Her concern for him had been ripped away, drowned in the confusion of her past, more words spilled forth.
I, as successor and as sign, do invoke my right to amendment. I hereby amend the terms, striking all but one. The demon on Isolix captor shall now and forevermore be free. From now until this sky does fall, no man, monster, nor beast shall hold him. He shall be bound to nothing.
She gasped as the memory freed her, as the weight in her hands became a mug once more. Hands gripped her shoulders, and the intensity of his grasp felt like pure electricity.
Fuck, I can't believe that was so stupid. Aradia, are you with me? I'm so sorry, I shouldn't have brought him up.
You're probably right, I'm catastrophizing over nothing. The past doesn't matter. It's 2012, we live in coastal Houston, and we have a party on Wednesday. I'm not going to spend the evening putting warded tin plate in the walls. And you're not going to sink into the floor without any dialogue from our past, right?
He looked at her desperately, clutched her like a lifeline, buzzed with crackles of energy.
Maybe he really had shocked her. She couldn't say for sure.
Right, yes, I'm fine. It was just a slip. You don't have to... We don't need to be afraid of the past.
She placed her hands over his, willing herself solid, willing herself warm. She felt his fingers twitch, and she focused on his eyes, the shimmering sapphire and ruby tones glinting with a strange light.
Green?
Babe, is that you or me doing that? He asked tentatively. Aradia, out of the corner of her eye, saw tiny crackles of lime-green lightning racing along her hands, mingling with Solix's red and blue in a decidedly friendly way. Aradia couldn't help but giggle.
That's me. It started a little after you left. Seemed like this priestess deal isn't one-sided anymore, she said.
Uncertainty slid across Solix's features, and though his arms tensed, he didn't let go of her.
What happened, exactly?
He was looking her over for some sign of imminent danger.
I teleported just like how the Lord does, she smiles. Isn't that incredible?
The power of a greater god with none of the tribulations of wizardry.
I wouldn't say none.
Solix brushed aside a piece of her hair that had floated in front of her face. Aradia hummed with pleasure as the tips of his fingers brushed her cheek.
Maybe not none, but nothing on the scale of life-ruining indoctrination, she conceded.
I want to spend time with the power, Solix. See if I can learn to ground myself.
Solix's brows knitted the motion.
That's not something I want you practicing alone. I especially don't want you inducing fading.
Solix, please.
Aradia cocked her head at him. She saw the nervousness in his eyes, the protectiveness as his hand fell to her hip. He looked away. But Aradia brought his gaze back with a hand on his jaw.
I'm not going anywhere, love.
She was rewarded with a shy smile that had just a bit of fang poking out. Solix leaned into her hand.
Okay.
For the full text of this and other stories by the same authors, visit the AO3 pages of Madam Melon Meow and Sarcastic Celery. Constant Conquest by Michael Guy Bowman. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information on my website, which is located at sangabrielvo.com. And there you can learn about other stories that I've read, my Discord server, and ways to support what I do. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.